The historic summer floods in Pakistan have mostly receded, but not the waterborne diseases left in their way.
Skin diseases, ulceration, erosions, and after that we saw malaria, a lot of patient malaria.
Climate change is expected to keep leading to outbreaks. Also today we meet the man who runs one of Japan's biggest cults. He claims to channel the spirits of dead leaders, from George Washington to Margaret Thatcher.
He wants to be the king of this world, and in order to realize his dreams, he's collecting all the believers to work towards his dream.
He's now recruiting followers in the U.S. And asteroid experts discover new minerals that are literally out of this world.
It's rare for anybody in my profession to find a new mineral and be able to describe it and name it, let alone two. And there could be more.
All that coming up today on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're listening to The World. Thanks for joining us today. We begin our coverage with a potentially big medical breakthrough in the treatment of Alzheimer's, a disease that's thought to affect more than 50 million people worldwide. Today, the results of a long-awaited trial were published in the New England Journal of Medicine. Dr. Jonathan Schott is up on the latest. He's a neurologist at the University College London Dementia Research Center and the chief medical officer for Alzheimer's Research UK. Dr. Schott, what is this new drug and what does it do that previous Alzheimer's drugs did not?
We've been working for a long period of time to understand the changes that occur when people develop Alzheimer's disease. And we know that a key part of the process is the accumulation of a protein called amyloid within the brain. And this amyloid protein, we think, accumulates over many years before people develop symptoms, and then it leads to a cascade which leads to brain cell loss and neurotransmitter failure, and then on to the cognitive symptoms that we recognize in patients with memory loss. But what's exciting about this drug is that in patients with mild Alzheimer's disease, it unequivocally and significantly removes this amyloid protein from the brain. And over an 18-month period, it slowed the patient's rates of cognitive decline by around a quarter. So we now have something that is getting into the brain, that's impacting on the biology of the brain in Alzheimer's disease, and is having some cognitive effects.
So from where you sit as a scientist who studies dementia, is this new drug lecanemab a game changer, or does it have the potential to be?
As a researcher, I'm extremely excited. And as a clinician, as a neurologist seeing patients, I have cautious optimism, given the potential difficulties we're going to have at delivering these drugs at scale, not least because of the costs and because of the monitoring required to make sure that they're delivered safely. So, as I say, cautious optimism as a clinician, but a lot of excitement as a researcher.
For the Alzheimer patients who took part in the drug trial, what impact did it have on their lives?
The changes that we saw were relatively modest, a 25% slowing over an 18-month period. There were some significant effects on some scales which are relative to quality of life and activities. But there's a lot of debate already starting about whether those changes make a significant difference that could be noticed by individual patients. But what I think is potentially important is if this is a drug that actually slows the progression of the disease, then we may well expect more benefits to accumulate over time. And that's why longer term studies and longer term follow up of these individuals is really very important.
Are you saying, though, that the drug is only useful in people who have not shown any cognitive symptoms of Alzheimer's?
So this drug trial was done in people who have mild Alzheimer's disease, and it still showed effects. Many of us in the field feel that we'll have even more benefits if we give it even earlier and before symptoms. And in an ideal world, what we want to do is to identify people who are at risk or who are developing this amyloid protein and treat them then and see actually then whether we can either delay or prevent the onset of cognitive symptoms. But that's some way down the line.
Since lecanemab only benefits people in the early stages of Alzheimer's, I mean, aren't there challenges of getting it to people in time, since Alzheimer's is usually diagnosed in later stages?
That's absolutely right. And I think that part of this and why announcements like this are important is it does even more to bring dementia and Alzheimer's disease out of the shadows. 20 years ago, people struggled to say the word cancer, and now everyone knows someone who's survived cancer. We have treatments. Then people come forward. Then we make more strides forward on a research basis. The public are now coming to us with concerns about dementia and therefore coming earlier You know, that's going to be to everyone's benefits. But we need, of course, the services to be able to see people, to diagnose people. And in particular, the development in the recent years of potential blood tests for Alzheimer's. If we can get down to blood tests, then suddenly this becomes a problem that we can tackle much more at scale, and we can tackle out in communities rather than just in very specialist centres.
Jonathan Schott is a neurologist at the University College London Dementia Research Centre and the Chief Medical Officer for Alzheimer's Research UK. Thanks very much, Jonathan.
Thank you very much.
In Pakistan, the floodwaters have largely receded. About a third of the country was inundated in late summer by intense and relentless monsoon rains. The health effects, however, they are not going away. In fact, there's been an uptick in waterborne illnesses and hunger. The World's Environment correspondent Carolyn Beeler visited a camp for displaced people in the hard-hit Dadu district of southern Pakistan to find out what people are facing.
Samira Vigio is waiting at the front of the health clinic tent when it opens. She's holding her two-day-old daughter on a cushion. The baby's not eating, Vigio tells me. When she drinks, she vomits. She has a fever and her stomach aches too, she says. She can't digest. Some of the moms crowded around suggest malaria. Vigio thinks it's a different problem. There's not enough milk in my breast to feed her, Vigio says. The only cooked food served here is rice. They bring it once in the morning and once in the evening, she tells me. About a quarter of the kids at camps like this one are severely malnourished, says Dr. Junaid Ahmed. He's taking temperatures and writing prescriptions at the front of the tent and has seen a progression of illnesses at these mobile clinics since late summer.
At the time of start of the flood, we saw a lot of patients with diarrhea. And then it was followed by skin diseases.
That was from drinking or wading through contaminated water. And then the mosquitoes started breeding in that standing water.
And after that, we saw malaria, a lot of patient malaria.
Malaria cases in Sindh province were three times higher in August than a year earlier. A young boy just tested positive after a finger prick for a blood test. His uncle, Ali Khan Jamali, says the boy has been sick for 8 days. He's not eating or drinking, Jamali tells me. He gets fevers often. Even now, sitting here, he'll start shivering. There are lots of mosquitoes around here, many of them, he says, with his hands on his nephew's shoulders. For his family of eight, there's only one mosquito net. We give it to the younger kids, he says. This year's rains in Pakistan were made more intense by climate change, and the World Health Organization expects global warming to have an increasing impact on human health. Dermid Campbell-Lindrum is the organization's head of climate change and health.
We estimate that even the relatively modest warming we expect to see by the 2030s would already be causing about 250,000 excess deaths a year.
That's from malaria, malnutrition, heat stress, and diarrhea. Higher temperatures make infectious diseases more infectious.
The pathogens tend to survive for longer. They tend to reproduce faster, either within the water bodies, if it's something like cholera, or within the insects, which transmit the diseases for diseases like malaria. So average increased temperatures favor transmission of these diseases.
Campbell Lindrum says no one is immune to the impacts of climate change. He points to the more than 70,000 people who died during a European heat wave in 2003. But the most exposed populations will still have it the worst.
So if you live in Pakistan and you don't have a safe water supply or a good sanitation system, then increasing temperatures and floods, which overflow your sanitation, are going to hit you more than somebody living in a good quality house. So across the board, it's those that are most vulnerable which are most at risk from climate change.
In Pakistan, the health impacts of climate change are piling up. The August floods damaged dozens of health centers in the hard-hit Dadu district. Dr. Ala Kareo, the head of pediatrics at the district hospital, says his unit is overcrowded. And he's worried about climbing rates of malnutrition as more families in this farming region fall into poverty.
Most of the lands and crops are under water. And the main source of income of our villagers is land. So their source of income is totally finished.
His colleague, Dr. Tasmina Pahwar, says they're already seeing newborns being born underweight. This can have lasting impacts.
They do suffer significant birth defects, so it does impact child in all terms and conditions, ranging from physical health to mental development.
She expects the health impacts of the floods here to last well beyond when the waters recede. For The World, I'm Carolyn Beeler, Dadu District, Pakistan.
A meteorite that landed in Somalia. That's what this next story is about. When researchers in Canada began examining it, they found something unusual. Meteorites contain iron and nickel, elements found here on Earth. But Professor Chris Hurd noticed that a slice of this meteorite in East Africa contained things that don't occur naturally on Earth. Hurd is an expert on meteorites at the University of Alberta and joins us. Chris, we want to hear more about what you discovered inside this meteorite, but set the stage for us first. A 15.5-ton meteorite in Somalia. Do you have any idea where in space it came from?
Well, as an iron meteorite, we think that it came from the core of an asteroid potentially, or at least from a portion of an asteroid that was especially rich in iron and nickel.
When was it found and who exactly found it?
It's actually been known for generations, apparently, in an area close to a location called El Ali in Somalia. It was known by camel herders for 5 to 7 generations at least as a place to stop and sharpen tools.
Do you know when it's believed the meteorite struck the Earth?
That's still to be determined. A colleague of mine is working on that to determine what we call its terrestrial age. I guess the remarkable thing is that we know that all iron meteorites, having originated from asteroids that were doing geology, if you will, early in the solar system's history, are probably around 4.5 billion years old. So it had quite a history before that.
So this is the El Ali meteorite because it was found near the town of El Ali. A sample was sent to you in Alberta for identification. How often does that happen?
We do classification, as it's called, in trying to determine what group a meteorite belongs to. And there are not many places that do iron meteorites. So it was sent to me, and a piece was also sent to UCLA, where they do similar types of analyses.
Right. And you got a few samples of it. Was there an aha moment? Like, how did your team discover that the meteorite contained something new?
In the course of classification, I was looking at sort of sub-millimeter scale rounded inclusions that contain minerals. And some of them were minerals that looked fairly familiar, from known from other studies. And there were a couple that I couldn't really identify, and then involved my colleague, Dr. Andrew Locock, who runs the what's called the electron microprobe lab here. And the first day that he was analyzing this meteorite on that instrument, he said, you've got at least 2 new minerals in there.
So let's be clear. These new minerals or these specific amalgamations of minerals, I mean, are they actually new chemical elements, not on the periodic table?
No, they're made of known chemical elements, specifically iron, phosphorus, and oxygen, but they're in a combination that has not been seen before on Earth, at least naturally.
So when your colleague at the University of Alberta pointed this out, how excited was he and what was your reaction?
I was blown away. I mean, it's rare for anybody in my profession to find a new mineral and be able to describe it and name it, let alone 2, and there could be more.
So your team in Alberta and researchers at UCLA, as you said, you've been working with small samples of the rock. As to the meteorite itself, it's no longer in Somalia. Do you know where it is?
Last I heard, it was in China. The owners have been looking for someone to buy it. It's really not clear exactly what will happen to it. The hope is that it would not be cut up into pieces. It's a significant size object. 15.5 tons makes it the 9th largest meteorite in the world ever discovered.
Wow.
But it also has the cultural significance to the country. And so it would be a shame that it left permanently, if you will, and was not recognized as something of cultural significance.
Professor Chris Hurd curates the University of Alberta's meteorite collection. He was telling us about his team's discovery of new minerals present in the El Ali meteorite that landed in Somalia a long time ago. Chris, thank you very much.
My pleasure.
A spiritual group in Japan with an origin story that starts on Venus is looking to expand to the U.S. That's just ahead. You're listening to The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. In Japan, they're known as new religious movements. Some people just call them cults. Either way, Japan has a lot of these upstart spiritual groups. In a country where most people don't follow any organized religion, self-proclaimed prophets have emerged to fill what they see as a void. One of the more successful is a man named Master Okawa. He describes himself as a reincarnated being from the planet Venus. Now he's looking to expand to here in the United States. The world's Patrick Nguyen has more.
Remember when the world was supposed to end back in 2012, according to a supposed Mayan prophecy? Well, it turns out the Earth was saved from destruction by a Japanese mystic, Master Yuho Okawa. That's what he claims anyway during his speeches.
There shall be no ending, no end of the world, because I have my mission.
Master Okawa is now 66. He wears spangly scarves and gold medallions and a perfect coif of black hair. But that's just his current form. Okawa says there is an alien god from Venus named El Cantare that sometimes comes down to Earth in human form, as Socrates, Jesus, Confucius, Buddha, and at the moment, Master Okawa himself. What is his mission, by the way? I put that question to his son, Hiroshi Okawa.
He
wants to be the king of this world, and in order to realize his dreams, he's collecting all the believers in order to work towards his dream.
Master Okawa and his team declined my interview request, so instead, I met with Hiroshi in Tokyo and asked, what is this spiritual leader like as a dad?
Well, I'm his actual son, but from when I was small, I was ordered to refer to my father as Master Ryuho Okawa.
What would happen if you just said, hey, dad?
Then I would be told that you are possessed by Satan.
Master Okawa's religious group is called Happy Science. He started it in the mid-80s after leaving a job as a Wall Street trader. His son, Hiroshi, says Happy Science is highly profitable. Followers are encouraged to donate piles of money to help Okawa achieve world peace. The other big revenue stream is books filled with prophecy. Before writing them, Master Okawa will go into a trance, channel the souls of celebrities and politicians, and convey their deepest thoughts. In another video produced by Happy Science, Okawa begins to channel the former British Prime Minister Margaret Thatcher just one day after she died in 2013.
Margaret Thatcher, Margaret Thatcher, come down to this place and answer our questions.
Once Okawa starts channeling Thatcher's spirit, his staff asks him questions.
You were dead yesterday.
Huh?
Can you understand?
I can't. I'm still alive.
Your ex-Prime Minister, Margaret Thatcher?
I've been Prime Minister. Dennis
is Thatcher's soul calling for her late husband, Dennis. Happy Science publishes thousands of books, Okawa channeling everyone from Moses to the Prophet Muhammad to Bruce Lee and Steve Jobs and Barack Obama. Yep, he claims to summon people who are still living. Hiroshi has sat by his father's side for many of these rituals, and one of them really stands out.
So Ryuho Okawa was trying to channel Michael Jackson's spirit, and he would make that iconic sound. That impersonation was so bad, but he was trying so hard.
Hiroshi says his dad's spiritual channeling is a total act, that his father groomed him to fake it too, asking him to channel a famous Japanese monk as believers watched in amazement. Hiroshi says, I just made stuff up. He was supposed to be his father's successor, but he quit Happy Science 5 years ago, saying the organization is steeped in lies. It claims more than 10 million followers. Hiroshi says, more like 13,000. And because Happy Science has probably maxed out its potential in Japan, Master Okawa is now looking towards America.
Fight for Trump!
Fight for Trump!
That's another online video showing Happy Science members chanting Fight for Trump on the streets of Tokyo, not long after the U.S. Capitol insurrection on January 6, 2021. In recent years, Master Okawa has courted Trump supporters hard by channeling Donald Trump's spirit for books called The Trump Secret or Trump Shall Never Die. Master Ryuho Okawa claims that Trump is the reincarnation of George Washington. Again, here's his son, Hiroshi.
Ryuho
has very strong interest in American politics, and that's because if you want to become the king of this world, then you have to first become king of the United States. And he really admires Donald Trump.
Master Okawa also loves to spread conspiracy theories about China. He says the COVID virus was transmitted to China by evil space aliens and that his spiritual vaccine can cure it. You can purchase the vaccine at Happy Science's U.S. headquarters in Manhattan or its outpost in California, Georgia, or Florida. As for Hiroshi Okawa, he's sending a message to Americans. Don't be fooled and do not donate to Happy Science unless you want to make a rich guy even richer.
He has built a four-story building, and it also has pool and tennis courts and sauna. He lives a lavish lifestyle.
Hiroshi also says his father doesn't seem to enjoy all that wealth, that he sits in his Tokyo mansion watching CNN, griping at the TV, telling off world leaders who appear on the screen. And that's the funny thing about Happy Science, he says. The self-anointed deity behind it all doesn't seem all that happy himself. For The World, this is Patrick Nguyen, Tokyo.
That story is part of our Sacred Nation reporting series about religion and nationalism around the globe. Check it out at theworld.org/sacrednation. The first Japanese-American to receive the Congressional Medal of Honor has died. Hiroshi Miyamura served in the U.S. Army in the Korean War. In the decade before, during World War II, he was detained in an internment camp. Miyamura enlisted to prove his loyalty to America. In this video from the Congressional Medal of Honor Society, he described arriving in North Korea in the middle of winter.
It was the coldest I've ever been in my life. Never received the food that we needed. Miserable.
When Chinese troops swept in, the U.S. Army was forced to retreat. Miyamura's unit was left alone on a mountaintop, vastly outnumbered, trying to hold off Chinese troops while their American comrades pulled back. Miyamura manned a machine gun and killed at least 50 Chinese soldiers. He was ultimately captured and spent more than 2 years as a prisoner of war. When he got out, he met with his commanding general.
And he said, do you know why you're here? And I said, no. He said, you had received the Medal of Honor. I remember all I could say was, what?
After Korea, Miyamura returned to his hometown of Gallup, Arizona, where he worked as a car mechanic. He died in Phoenix yesterday at the age of 97. You're listening to The World. LGBTQ soccer fans respond to intolerance at Qatar's World Cup. Some are making their voices heard on social media. Others won't even turn on their TVs.
It's quite painful because I love watching, but, you know, I just think it's best to boycott.
And the opposite of licking your wounds, why some Iranian soccer fans were rooting for Team USA to beat them. All still ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. We're a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX. A World Cup stunner. Wow, where do you even begin? At the World Cup in Qatar this evening, Tunisian fans are beside themselves with this David versus Goliath victory. Their team beating France, the World Cup defending champions. The former colonial power in Tunisia now brought to its knees on the soccer pitch. The last few minutes of the match were an emotional roller coaster. Tunisia was ahead, but France scored a late goal. The game would end in a dreaded tie, but then no, a video review and... France's goal revoked, an incredible moment in the game. Soccer fans globally, though, have had to reconcile their love of the game with serious concerns off the pitch. As you know, this tournament has been dogged by accusations of human rights abuses. LGBTQ groups in particular have been speaking out. FIFA and Qatari officials have said everyone is welcome at the tournament. In Qatar, though, homosexuality is illegal, punishable with prison time. So some LGBTQ soccer fans are staying home and sitting out this World Cup. The World's Bianca Hillier reports.
When England played in the semifinals at the 2018 World Cup, Three Lions Pride was cheering in the stands. They're the team's largest LGBTQ fan group. Members waved rainbow scarves in the air and even felt welcomed in the Russian stadium. But this time around, things are entirely different.
As a group, Three Lions Pride will not be traveling to this World Cup.
Di Cunningham is a co-founder of the group. She spoke at a press briefing earlier this month.
We're not traveling this year, mainly because we understand from our counterparts, the Qatari nationals, that our visibility there, our presence, would render them vulnerable to systematic institutional and potentially vigilante abuse.
But others have decided to take the trip. Laura McAllister is a former captain for the Welsh team. At a game last week, she walked in wearing a rainbow bucket hat.
Once we went through security, we were approached by some of the stewards and security staff and told that we couldn't enter the stadium wearing the rainbow bucket hat.
McAllister told the BBC security asked her to take her hat to a holding area where she could collect it after the match.
So I walked towards that, but I think as a very small protest of my own, I managed to stick my hat in my pocket, so we had our hats.
She said she wasn't approached again, even after briefly putting the hat on for a photo. Overall, she said she does feel safe at the World Cup as an openly gay fan. Peter Tatchell, a longtime LGBTQ activist in London, says despite being a football enthusiast, he isn't attending the games and won't even watch on TV.
It's quite painful because I love watching, but, you know, I just think it's best to boycott.
Instead, Tatchell flew to Doha before the tournament and stood outside the Qatar National Museum. He held a sign saying, "Qatar is anti-gay."
I was immediately detained. They confiscated my placard. They did a lot of the communications via Google Translate. And the first message was, "This protest is not permitted. This is a very serious offense. You're going to be in big trouble." At which point, I got very scared.
Tatchell ended up being released within an hour and left Qatar that same day. He believes that's because of who he is and where he's from.
If I'd been a Qatari person, I would now be behind bars.
Tatchell says human rights advocates in Qatar encouraged his protest in order to get international media attention. But other members of Qatar's LGBTQ community criticized Tatchell's protest for putting people at risk inside the country.
Going in with a sign screaming at the regime, "You're anti-gay," and leaving is really not a good move.
Physician Nas Mohammed is the first and currently only Qatari to publicly come out as gay. He now lives in San Francisco and is seeking political asylum. Throughout this World Cup, Mohammed has been working to highlight what it's really like for queer people in Qatar.
They feel like they're dying from the inside out. These are the words that they use to describe the experience, because showing that one aspect of who you are can result in so many challenges.
If not put in jail, Mohammed says LGBTQ people are often unable to get jobs or integrate into society. They also become targets of violence from their own family. Mohammed himself has been completely disowned by his family. He's using his relative safety as a financially independent person in the U.S. to speak for those still in Qatar.
They don't even want their voice to be recognized, like to just let you know how terrified people are of the consequences.
As these issues continue to get widespread attention during the tournament, Mohammed says LGBTQ people there are having a range of reactions.
Some people are afraid about retaliation after the World Cup. Some people are really excited to see that there is global advocacy. It's all kind of reactions, honestly.
Overall, Mohammed's goal is to bring the focus back to Qatar's own queer community and their reality. He recently started an LGBTQ fan group called Proud Maroons, named after Qatar's national football team, and made this recording to sound like people cheering in a stadium, which he's been sharing on social media.
And it's just to show that here is an LGBT supporters group that can't have fans join its own nation because they would be jailed.
Instead, the group is made up of more than 87,000 people who are cheering for the rights of LGBTQ Qataris from across the globe. For The World, I'm Bianca Hillier.
Just in case you were not alerted, the U.S. beat Iran 1-0 yesterday to advance to the next round of the World Cup. Sounds of celebration there coming from inside Iran. Orzu Daragahi is here to tell us why that's happening. He's a correspondent with The Independent and a senior fellow with the Atlantic Council. So clips on Twitter, Borzu, show some Iranians celebrating in the streets in the city of Mashhad after their team lost. Explain that. Do we know why?
Not just in Mashhad, all over Iran. You know, Iranians are crazy about football. They adore football. They very much follow their national players and their national team. But this year, because of the ongoing uprising triggered by the death in custody of 22-year-old Mahsa Amini, the country's become extremely polarized. And those in the opposition have been demanding that the players on the national team defy the regime in some way, either by boycotting the World Cup or making gestures of defiance.
Borzu, let's go back to 1998, the last time Iran and the U.S. met at the World Cup. Iran won. There were wild celebrations back home, a big contrast with what we're seeing today. Are you hearing comparisons between these two World Cups, the before in 98 and the after in 2022?
Yeah, absolutely. And if you think about it, 1998, you know, politics played a role too. It was a year after Mohammad Khatami won a surprise victory in the presidential elections. He was talking about reform. He was talking about giving rights to women and minorities. Iran was changing. Everyone was in much better spirits. And now is a much more bitter time and a much more angry time. There's no hope of reform. All the Iranians that I talk to in the country, they all, whether they're pro-government or anti-government or even just neutral, trying to just get out of the country at this point, they foresee a long, bloody road ahead.
So after the Iranian players refused to sing their country's national anthem, there have been reports of threats against the players and their families. What do we know about that?
Yeah, there's some famous top-notch soccer players who have said publicly that they have been threatened and menaced. And then there are reports sourced to mostly anonymous people that the players have also been threatened after they refused to budge on the national anthem. Themselves and their families were threatened by regime operatives. In the ensuing games, they sang against Wales and against the United States. They participated in the national anthem.
What could this all mean potentially when these players and fans return to Iran?
Well, I'm sure that when they return to Iran, the regime will orchestrate warm welcoming for these guys when they arrive at the airport. But you know, you might also see some counter-protesters. You might see clashes. Really, the society, Iranian society, is more divided than it ever has been. You know, like, for example, Medli means national in Persian. So instead of calling it Team Medli, they're calling it Team Mullah, those in the opposition, really criticizing the players, really turning out against it. It was quite extraordinary, nothing you've ever seen before. There was fireworks in the streets everywhere all around the country. People were celebrating, cheering, and so on, and they were cheering the fact that this Team Mullah had lost.
Do we know how the authorities in Iran reacted when this happened? I mean, was there any immediate response?
I mean, they responded to the protesters and the people on the streets celebrating. They responded with characteristic violence. And there are some reports of even people killed, shot, and killed in the ensuing celebrations.
Some Iranian fans in Qatar have complained that authorities there have prohibited them, in some cases, from protesting against the government in Tehran. What do you know about that?
We did a report based on leaked documents that were obtained from an Iranian news agency in which captains of the Revolutionary Guard are heard boasting in audio that they're collaborating with the Qatari authorities, and they have names of the fans that are coming to Qatar and have picked out the troublemakers. Now, I spoke to a Qatari official who, you know, vehemently denied this accusation. And what this Qatari official told me was like, yes, he had conceded that, in fact, we have taken special precautions with regard to the Iran matches because of the volatility. And that is only for the protection of the fans and the players. But they're not going around trying to help the Iranian Revolutionary Guard and intelligence services arrest dissidents.
Borzu, do you think Iranian athletes will continue to protest against their government going forward? I mean, there's a lot of risk in that, isn't there?
I think some are and some will. I think for these particular players, they're kind of young, you know, and they're naive and they're like jocks everywhere. And they're, you know, this was a great opportunity for them to play in the World Cup. It only comes around once every 4 years. So I'm sure they were just overwhelmed by the politics of it.
Borzu Daragahi is a correspondent with The Independent and a senior fellow with the Atlantic Council. Thanks for discussing this, Borzu. Really appreciate it.
Always a pleasure, Marco.
The Biden administration has pledged $53 million to help Ukraine rebuild its electrical grid. Russian drone and rocket attacks have damaged about a quarter of Ukraine's energy infrastructure. That's according to U.S. officials. Rebuilding is going to take time, and the cold of winter is already upon Ukraine. Most cities have seen their first snow. Nighttime temperatures in the capital Kyiv are dropping below freezing. The World's Shirin Jafari reports on how people are coping and preparing for the next few months.
Before the war began, the Gorgani camping store in Kyiv attracted the type of customers you would expect. You had your outdoor enthusiasts, camping fans, and hikers. But in the past few months, as Russian forces began to target Ukraine's infrastructure, like water and electricity, the clientele here has changed. We are seeing families with kids, older people, and people who work in offices, says Olesya Kotenko. She's a 26-year-old sales rep. The store has been busy, Kotenko says. People are buying camping stoves, sleeping bags, and headlamps, basic essentials for what is shaping up to be a very harsh winter. In recent weeks, Russia has deliberately increased its attacks on Ukraine's energy infrastructure. The strikes have left millions of people without reliable electricity, clean water, and heat. Ukrainian workers repair the damage, but often facilities are targeted again. Sometimes spare parts are needed from abroad, and that slows down the repairs. Last month, Russian lawmaker Andrei Gruliev talked about these attacks on Russian TV. These strikes have been extremely effective, he declared, and more of them are necessary to bring Ukraine to its knees. Gruliev went on to imply that Russia should starve and freeze Ukrainians this winter in order to force them to flee the country. Stephen Rapp is a former U.S. ambassador at large for war crimes issues.
The targeting of infrastructure necessary to civilian survival as a matter of national policy, it is, by its very essence, a war crime.
Rapp, who was speaking at an event at Georgetown University last month, said that President Vladimir Putin himself has talked about this as a strategy, meaning the targeting of civilian energy sites is coming from the top of Russia's chain of command. This sound is becoming more and more common in Ukrainian towns and cities. Diesel generators are noisy and they produce a nasty smell, but they're necessary to keep the lights on in businesses, hospitals, and offices. At the camping store, 20-year-old Oleg Dudkin is browsing the aisles, looking for a backpack. He's tall and has a shock of brown hair. He says he's also buying emergency supplies in case his family has no power for an extended period this winter. He has a long list of stuff to buy.
But it all boils down to stay warm, don't starve.
To keep warm, he's getting a jacket and thermal underwear. For food, he's buying packets of ready-to-eat meals. Dudkin says he considers himself lucky to even have access to these items here in the capital.
For a lot of people, especially old people, people who cannot care for themselves, and without electricity, without heat, for them it's... I think about that from time to time and it's scary.
It's not just the elderly and the sick that has humanitarian aid groups worried. Sonia Kush, country director for Save the Children, says kids are at risk too.
It is really cold in Ukraine right now, and it's hard to imagine that if a child is sitting at home without power, how can they stay warm and still, you know, try to be happy and healthy and connect with their friends and get an education.
Kush's organization recently surveyed 1,600 parents. It found that the lack of electricity is having an impact on children's overall health as well as their education.
This sort of punitive punishment of civilians across the country is going to have long-term effects on the population, especially children. Children should never be a target. They should not be affected.
Kush says the government and humanitarian groups in Ukraine are taking steps to help. For example, they've set up designated locations where people can get shelter, charge their phones, and stay warm. But Kush says these are short-term solutions. What's really needed is for this war to end. For the world, Shirin Jafari, Kyiv, Ukraine.
A former leader of China died today in Shanghai. Jiang Zemin came to power in the aftermath of the 1989 Tiananmen Square protests. He remained at the helm for 13 years, ushering in an era of extraordinary economic growth in China. At the same time, he ensured that the Chinese Communist Party would retain absolute political power. Jiang Zemin was 96. Robert Lawrence Kuhn met Jiang many times. Kuhn is the author of The Man Who Changed China, The Life and Legacy of Jiang Zemin. Robert, take us back to that moment when Jiang Zemin was anointed a leader of China's Communist Party. Early 1990s, where was China at economically and politically?
China was going backwards very significantly. There were sanctions in the world, condemnations, uncertainty within China. Jiang Zemin at the time was party secretary of Shanghai and was planning on going into retirement. He looked forward to being a professor. And then the call came from Deng Xiaoping, and it totally transformed China.
As you say, after Tiananmen Square, Beijing was scorned internationally, became the global poster child for attacks on civil liberties, and there's that photo of Tank Man showing Chinese desire for freedom. How did Jiang go about trying to fix that and achieving stability and prosperity?
When he came into office with all the turmoil, he told his closest personal friend, who told me, he said, "My head is spinning. I don't know what I'm doing here." So during this time, he was under pressure from conservative leaders to move the country back to not the Cultural Revolution, I'm not saying that, but to a statist approach to government. And then give Deng Xiaoping the credit, because in early 1992, so it's like, what, 2.5 years later after Jiang was appointed, Deng made his famous, it's called Nanshun, which means a sort of a southern trip, in which he, without any power whatsoever, started to talk about reform and said, anybody who doesn't do reform should be removed from office. And so at the end of that 6-week period, Jiang made a decision that we're going to go with Deng and we're going to start reform. And that was his natural predilection anyway, and that began the whole process.
And in radically changing China's economy, pushing for reforms and entry into the World Trade Organization, Jiang also had a serious impact on the global economy, right?
Oh, for sure. Americans don't realize that our standard of living, even though there's great problems that the U.S. has with China, that our standard of living has been enhanced, all of us, every one of us, by our economic relationship with China. We get better quality products at lower prices. We can buy more of it because of the diligence and commitment of Chinese workers who labored long and hard in the early days of reform. Jiang's era was transformational.
How well do you think other countries understood at the time the impact that China's economic change would have on them?
When I began going to China, which was in 1990, everybody in the world thought China was a basket case. I had a very close business associate who said to me, "Robert, you're wasting your time in China because China won't mean anything for the world for 1,000 years. Not 100 years, but 1,000 years. Mm. And if you talk to any of the senior people in China, nobody had any expectation that they would have anything like what has happened during their lifetime. But you can look at every economic trend and you could trace its origin to the period of time that Jiang Zemin was leader.
And now, 30 years later, the global economy in many ways is reliant on China. I mean, just going to any box store here in the United States. Is that a scenario that causes regret or misgivings?
Other than climate change, the biggest problem today is global inequality and poverty. China has been by far the world leader in this. One could say 800, 850 million people in China were brought out of extreme poverty. The first 700 million of them were brought about, beginning with Jiang and then Hu Jintao, just by simple economic development. They didn't have to have anti-poverty campaign. From Jiang Zemin's point of view, one of his greatest transformative acts was to transform the Communist Party itself. It was done through something called the Three Represents, which sounds banal on its surface, but underneath it basically enabled entrepreneurs, the personification of capitalism, to join the Communist Party and to become full-fledged members of society. That move really enabled the entire private sector to grow with respectability and great strength.
Robert, you met Jiang Zemin many times. Is there a personal note about him, something that stood out for you about the man?
Look, I'd say he was an effervescent, normal human being who was a great Chinese patriot. a staunch believer in the party. He was a young, very young man in his late teens and early 20s during the Civil War and the Revolution, and that fervency of that revolution stayed with him his whole life. But he recognized reality. At the beginning of his term, he had heard some entrepreneurs making money by setting up little business stands in Beijing, and he got very angry. And he said, you know, this is undermining the ideology of the party. They're all going to be thrown out. And they were. Then, about 8-9 years later, he came over to a senior minister who was a very close friend of mine and said this. He said, Minister so-and-so, I have to apologize to you and to the country for what I did at that point. I didn't understand economics. I didn't understand business. He said, I'm a patriot. I love China. And I'm an engineer, and I know what works. When the boiler in my factory that I worked didn't work, I know I had to fix it. There was no ideology involved. And so I understand that the market economy is critical for China. Now, that didn't undermine his view of the primacy and sole leadership of the party, but it did enable him to make decisions that would be lasting and enable China to have the great transformation it did. I call it the greatest transformation in history by the largest population on Earth.
Robert Lawrence Kuhn is the author of The Man Who Changed China, The Life and Legacy of Jiang Zemin. Thank you very much for joining us for this conversation, Robert.
It's a pleasure.
The baguette, that skinny, crispy, and chewy symbol of France, not just any old piece of bread, it's now officially on the United Nations Cultural Heritage List. I could not agree more. The traditional baguette has 5 ingredients: flour, water, salt, yeast, and patience on the clock. To make a baguette is to reject the frenetic pace of modern life. Mahmoud Nsedi is a master baker in Paris.
Si on respecte pas le temps, eh ben, on n'aura jamais une bonne tradition.
He says if you do not respect time, you will never get a good loaf. There's even a law governing baguette making. In France, the baguette has to be legal. The 1993 Décret Pain, or Bread Decree, states all traditional baguettes need to be made on the premises where they're sold. They cannot be frozen. They cannot contain additives. But that does not mean all baguettes are created equal. So how do you separate the wheat from the chaff? For this, I defer to the bread scene from the movie Ratatouille about a cartoon rat who loves to cook.
How do you tell how good bread is without tasting it? Not the smell, not the look, but the sound, the crust. Listen. Oh, symphony of crackle. Only great bread sound this way.
Ooh la la. That crackle, please, one more time. You know what that fluffy center, that crumb, can be used for? Sopping up the tears of French soccer fans after their team's extraordinary loss to Tunisia today. Or let it dry out and make French toast. Your call. The World comes to you from the Nan and Bill Harris studio in Boston and the Department of Communication at UC San Diego. I'm Marco Werman. See you back here tomorrow.